Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Warning. This episode of Haunted American History contains disturbing descriptions and scenarios. Listener discretion is advised.
A damp, dreary January morning crept over Los Angeles. It's the kind that evokes the memory of a winter's chill, even in the warmth of California. Fog hung low, obscuring the palm trees and casting the city into grayscale. There was no glitz and glamour today, just cold and gloom. The day was January 15th, and the year, 1947. Despite being less than 10 miles from the heart of Hollywood, a heinous crime was about to take place, sending shockwaves throughout the nation and creating a mystery that would endure through time. In the dark early hours of that morning, someone was disposing of the remains of a woman in an abandoned lot. The victim had been disfigured, dismembered, and discarded, shocking even the most hardened members of society. The media quickly descended on Hollywood, exposing its seedy underbelly. From the world of gangsters and prostitutes to the wild parties of celebrity elites, this brutal and unsolved murder would become known as one of the most notorious cases in American history. I'm Christopher Feinstein, and this is Haunted American History, the case of the Black Dahlia murder. Betty Bersinger's world in the Leimert Park neighborhood of South Los Angeles was a far cry from Hollywood glamour. Despite her beauty, she lived a simple life focused on caring for her three-year-old daughter. On one cold morning, Betty set out for her local shoe repair shop with her daughter in tow, a trip that would change her life and make her a part of criminal history. As she walked between Coliseum Street and West 39th, Betty may have noticed the vacant lots on South Norton Avenue's west side. Among them stood one particular sight that caught her eye. Perhaps she saw it as just another discarded piece of trash. But there was something about it that still seemed off to her. As she approached, she couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. And then she saw it. What she initially thought was a mannequin turned out to be a severed body. Panicked, Betty quickly called out for help. LAPD officers Will Fitzgerald and Frank Perkins were the first to arrive and confirmed that Betty's discovery was indeed a body. They immediately called for backup and began their investigation. The first thing they noticed was how the body had been posed, lying on its back with arms raised and legs spread in an obscene fashion. The two halves of the body were lying about a foot apart, with guts neatly tucked back under the buttocks. But that wasn't all. There were cuts and missing pieces of flesh on the body, including a tattoo on the thigh that had been removed and inserted into the victim's vagina. The face also showed signs of brutal disfiguration, known as a Glasgow smile, often associated with street gang violence. In addition to being completely drained of blood, there was no blood at the scene, leaving police to believe that this was simply a dump site and not where the murder took place. Dew underneath the body indicated that it had been placed there after 2 a.m., likely transported there by a vehicle. Police also found rope marks on the victim's ankles, wrists, and neck, suggesting that she had been held captive before her death. The commotion at the lot soon attracted a crowd, including members of the press eager for photographs. The area was quickly cleared as police worked to collect evidence and remove the body, which was taken to the Los Angeles County Morgue. Among the evidence found were tire tracks and a heel print, along with a cement sack containing watery blood, potentially used to transport the body. At the coroner's office, a thorough autopsy was performed to uncover the extent of the injuries sustained by the victim. in addition to what was initially visible. The coroner noted severe bruising on the front and right side of the head that had caused internal bleeding. The body had also lacerations on the right forearm, upper left arm, and lower left side of the chest. It was evident that there had been a sexual aspect to this crime as well. Evidence showed dilation in her anal cavity and cuts in the pubic area. Although no semen was found, it appeared that the perpetrator may have used an object during the assault, as there was also injuries in her anus. Further examination revealed that she had feces in her stomach. Her cause of death was determined to be a combination of shock from head trauma and hemorrhaging from other wounds. Upon closer inspection, medical examiners determined that her body had been bisected using a specific method called hemicorporectomy, where the body is amputated below the waist by cutting through the second and third lumbar vertebrae. The bisection occurred after her death. As news began to spread about this brutal murder, LAPD faced immense pressure to identify the victim quickly. They sent her fingerprints over wire photo, which was typically used by the media for transmitting photographs. The local newspaper, Herald Express, helped with this effort. Eventually, the FBI identified her as Elizabeth Short. Elizabeth was a 22-year-old woman from Boston who moved to California to live with her father. After a falling out with him, she had several relationships, at least one of which was abusive. She had been engaged but tragically lost her fiancé during World War II. Grieving and struggling financially, she turned to living with various people to avoid homelessness and worked as a waitress. Despite these hardships, she managed to maintain multiple romantic relationships, including one with Robert Manley, also known as Red. Though their relationship was not sexual, according to Manley, it should be noted that he was married and may not have been truthful about the extent of their affair. Manley was the last person with Short before her murder. He dropped her off at the Biltmore Hotel. She had told him that she was meeting her sister there, but this was a lie. Some speculate she may have actually been meeting another man or simply wanted to end things with Manley. Despite being discharged from the army for mental instability and claiming to hear voices, Manley passed two polygraph tests and had a solid alibi for the time of Short's murder. However, it is believed that the crime affected him greatly, and he was eventually committed to a psychiatric hospital in 1954. From the very beginning, the media's involvement in the case was mired in controversy, as they straddled the line between being unbiased and actively inserting themselves into the investigation. This resembled their intrusive role in the Jack the Ripper murders in Great Britain, which had achieved a similar level of sensationalism and notoriety as the Black Dahlia case. Within hours of Short being identified, the Los Angeles Examiner contacted her mother Phoebe under false pretenses, claiming that Short had won a beauty contest and was only seeking information. Only after extracting all they could from her did they reveal that her daughter had actually been murdered. But their cruelty didn't stop there. After promising to fly Phoebe to LA to aid in the investigation, they kept her away from the police and continued to use her as a source for new headlines. The relationship between the LAPD and another newspaper, the Herald Express, was unhealthy and potentially unethical. Owned by billionaire William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper provided leads to the police in exchange for exclusives. Sensationalism became the name of the game for other papers like The Examiner and The LA Times, with them adding hints of sex and scandal to further captivate readers. These claims not only hindered the investigation, but also left a lasting impact on how some still view Short as either a high-class escort or a street prostitute, despite no evidence supporting either claim. On January 17th, the Herald Express first referred to Short as the Black Dahlia, a nickname she acquired at a drugstore in Los Angeles. The first major development in the case occurred just 6 days after Short's body was discovered. J.H. Richardson, editor of The Examiner at the time, received a call in his office from someone claiming to be the Black Dahlia killer. The mysterious caller wanted to discuss how the newspaper was covering the case and offered to send Short's belongings to prove their identity. Soon after, the Examiner received a package containing Short's personal items addressed to the Los Angeles Examiner and other Los Angeles papers. The address and note were created by cutting words from newspaper headlines. Despite partial fingerprints being retrieved by the LAPD, they were compromised while being transported by the FBI and could not be properly analyzed. The package contains Short's business cards, birth certificate, photographs, and an address book with the name Mark Hansen embossed on the front. That same day, more of Short's belongings were found on top of a trash can 2 miles from where her body was discovered. These items had also been wiped clean with gasoline and were identified by Robert Manley. Authorities had initially suspected that the killer of Short may have been someone that she personally knew, judging by the way her body was positioned and the presence of a personal grudge symbolized by the Glasgow smile. Further investigation revealed that Short had stayed with Mark Hansen prior to her death, making him a prime suspect in the murder. This was despite the fact that he wouldn't have purposely left his address book with his name on it for the press to find. Rumors suggest that this address book contained names of famous Hollywood figures and was covered up by the LAPD. However, this claim has proven to be false, and Hansen would later tell police that he had given Short the book as a gift. Mark Hansen's name has frequently appeared in connection to the Black Dahlia case. Not only was his name found in and on Short's address book, but it was also linked to several other suspects and had known Elizabeth Short personally. It was unclear what their exact relationship was, but it has been heavily scrutinized over the years. Hansen owned multiple theaters, 2 boarding houses, and had part ownership of a nightclub on Hollywood Boulevard. Born in Denmark in 1890, he was successful in business, but otherwise unremarkable. He showed no signs of sadism or any kind of criminal tendencies. However, he did have a reputation as a ladies' man, and only hired young and attractive women to work at his club. He was also known to attend sex parties privately. Short had stayed with Hansen for 2 weeks in October of 1946 and then 10 days in November before he eventually asked her to leave due to her associations which he deemed unfavorable. This is ironic considering notorious gangster Mickey Cohen was known to frequent Hansen's nightclub. The police were interested in Hansen's activities at the club, and there were rumors that they accepted bribes to keep it open. Despite this, there is no concrete evidence that links Hansen to organized crime. His club attracted celebrities and average citizens alike. Some believe that Hansen and Short were romantically involved, while others suggest that she rejected his advances. Another theory is that she led him on and angered him when she made it clear that she wasn't really interested. Some claim there was no relationship between the two, and Hansen simply allowed a desperate woman to stay in his home out of concern for her safety. These conflicting accounts are a trend in the Black Dahlia case, where evidence is often confusing and contradictory. Running a successful nightclub in 1940s Los Angeles likely meant that not all of Hansen's activities were completely legal, but there is no evidence indicating that he had any level of psychosis seen in the Black Dahlia killing. Hansen had no history of violence, and he reportedly felt genuinely sorry for Elizabeth Short, and he was worried about the potentially dangerous people she surrounded herself with. Now, having said that, this doesn't discount the fact that there may have been hazardous individuals in Hansen's circle and ones that would frequent his nightclub, some of whom eventually caught the attention of law enforcement. It wasn't long before the press and the Los Angeles District Attorney started receiving letters in the same style as the one attached to the packet. The letters, made up of cutouts from headlines, seemed to suggest that the killer was experiencing some kind of crisis. One letter sent to the Herald Express read, "I will confess the killing of Dahlia if I receive a 10-year sentence. Don't try to track me down." Another one sent to the Examiner stated, "Here it is. Turning it in on Wednesday, January 29th at 10 a.m. Had my fun with the police. Black Dahlia Avenger." Police were waiting and ready at the specified location, but instead of a suspect showing up, they received a second letter later that afternoon. It said, "I've changed my mind. You would never give me a fair deal. Killing Dahlia was justified." The authenticity of these letters is still debated today. But at the time, police didn't believe any of them were genuine. What's similar, during the infamous Jack the Ripper case in London, both police and press received numerous letters claiming to be from the killer. While some are believed to be authentic, many were later revealed to be hoaxes and pranks. In fact, in 1931, journalist Fred Best admitted that he and a colleague at the Star newspaper had faked the well-known Dear Boss letter and Saucy Jackie postcard in order to boost sales of their paper. However, this tactic of taunting and involving the media in their crime is not uncommon among serial killers, such as the Zodiac, the Unabomber, and the Son of Sam. The primary purpose behind these behaviors is often to reinforce their belief that their own superiority and power they have over others. They may also have a personal grudge against those they want to taunt or want to spread their perceived message or ideology by gaining public attention. With each new letter, the press coverage increased, and so did the influx of tips. Unfortunately, most of these leads turned out to be useless. The case quickly spiraled into a media circus, with constant press intrusion and an overwhelming amount of information for the LAPD to sift through. But despite the chaos, police were able to keep crucial details about Short and the murder under wraps in hopes of using them during future interrogation and arrests. In the following weeks, newspapers began speculating that Elizabeth Short was a lesbian who had played with men's emotions and then disappointed them. This insinuated that she had lived a dangerous lifestyle, implying that she was partially responsible for her own death. This is why you never, ever, 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 ever trust the media. Elizabeth Short's killer probably knew her personally. The nature of her injuries suggests a personal motive and knowledge of specific violent methods, which is not common among the general population. The Glasgow Smile, which is popular among street gangs in Scotland and England, may indicate that the killer had connections or familiarity with criminal activities or law enforcement. There is a misconception about how this type of injury is inflicted. Usually, it starts with small incisions at the corners of the mouth made by the perpetrator, not all the way toward the ears. Then the victim is usually beaten, causing their facial muscles to contract and tear open the incisions further. This would have been an agonizing experience for Short. It is also worth noting that she was also struck on the head. The type of injury suggests something that is called the Glasgow kiss, which is usually just a blunt force, usually it's a headbutt. The killer may have expected Short to survive, as most victims of the Glasgow Smile do, but unfortunately it suggested that she bled out from her injuries. The attack was done with the intention to disfigure and control the victim, likely by a man trying to assert his dominance over her. The removal of Short's pubic hair suggests a possible sexual motive, and the tattoo on her thigh, which would have been shown off to men, was also removed and placed inside of her vagina. The positioning of her body and meticulous placement of the organs suggest that the killer had ample time and space to further mutilate and dispose of the body, but instead chose to display it for the world to see. This was likely part of their criminal signature, as they wanted to make a statement about what they believed Short deserved. After ruling out suspects such as Hanley and Hansen, attention turned towards doctors and medical students due to the advanced knowledge required for the bisection of the body. Among them was a man named Walter Bailey, who lived just a block away from where Short's body was found and possibly knew her through his daughter's friendship with Short's sister. However, there was no evidence linking him to the crime, and he had no history of violence or any criminal background whatsoever. It was later discovered that he had been suffering from a degenerative brain disease at the time of the murder, which may have affected his behavior. Despite this speculation, Bailey was never considered a suspect by police in the original case, and there is no proof that he even knew Short. Additionally, he was living with his wife at the time of the killing, making it difficult for him to have committed such a gruesome act without anyone knowing. Hey folks, I am doing something a little different this week, as you all can tell because you've been listening to the show for about 20 minutes. the unsolved cases and famous murders and things like that in the United States have always fascinated me. And they are a part of this haunted American history that I so talk about all the time, even though they're not haunted by ghosts per se. But the very acts of some of these murders and mysteries are haunting. So this is something I would like to talk about. So yeah, so here I'm going to, from now that we finished with the states, I'm going to sprinkle in some of these kind of unsolved cases from around the United States before I venture back into start doing the states, or I might just intersperse them, do one like this, the Black Dahlia, something I've wanted to talk about for a very long time, a case that really, really intrigues me. And yeah, so I'm going to talk about this for a little while, then, you know, head to some of the territories of the United States, talk about the ghost stories and folklore of that, and then back to some unsolved stuff, back and forth like that. So that's the plan for the show going forward, until I revisit all the states again. But yeah, I want to thank everybody for reaching out, and this is weird, this one. I feel weird doing this, saying like a list of thank yous and stuff in the middle, after just speaking so heinously about what's been going on in this. So I'm probably just going to stop now. Thank you all so much. You know I love you. Let's keep going with the Black Dahlia. Dr. Patrick O'Reilly definitely knew Short, as they had stayed with nightclub owner Mark Hansen together. O'Reilly was a medical doctor and a dangerous sexual predator who attended sex parties in Malibu with Hansen. He had a history of sexually motivated crime, having previously assaulted his secretary for the sole purpose of satisfying his sexual desires. It is possible that O'Reilly killed Short and then purposely sent her address book to the police, listing Hansen's name as a way to frame him for the murder. O'Reilly knew that Hansen had connections to Short and other dubious individuals, making him an easy target for suspicion. Despite 750 members of the LAPD working on the case, leads started to dwindle, and despite numerous confessions, no strong suspect emerged. Out of the 60 confessions, most were dismissed and some were even charged with obstruction of justice. Despite this, the investigation was very thorough, with thousands of interviews conducted and extensive searches carried out in storm drains, abandoned buildings, and lots. At the time, police blamed the Los Angeles press for hindering their progress, while later investigations would point to other issues within the LAPD, such as corruption and internal conflicts. Although the active case went cold after just a few weeks, it would not be the last time America heard about the Black Dahlia. In October of 1948, a bellhop named Leslie Dillon inserted himself into the case by writing a letter to a psychiatrist at the Los Angeles Police Department. Dillon claimed to have read about the case in a crime magazine where Dr. J. Paul DeRiver had commented on it. Dillon revealed that he had his own suspect, a friend he called Jeff Connors, who he claimed killed Short after she threatened to expose their inappropriate relationship. However, DeRiver eventually concluded that Connors did not exist and that Dillon was actually responsible for killing the Black Dahlia himself. DeRiver's actions following the initial contact were unexpected. Perhaps driven by a desire for personal recognition and fame, he abandoned the official investigation and took matters into his own hands, recruiting detectives from the Gangster Squad. They arranged a meeting with the bellhop in Las Vegas, as Dillon was wary of returning to Los Angeles. The pair then traveled to San Francisco to search for Connors, who had supposedly left LA after the Black Dahlia murder. During this time, Dillon shared new information about the crime, claiming that the killer may have flushed body parts down the toilet and drained blood through an incision in the thigh. He insisted he had experience with these techniques from working as a mortician's assistant, and that the victim was killed at a motel. The Gangster Squad eventually took Dillon into custody and brought him back to LA, where they tried to force a confession out of him while holding him against his will in a hotel room. Dillon later spoke to the press, revealing that he had been stripped naked and handcuffed to a radiator during this ordeal. He was finally taken to Highland Park Station on January 10th, 1949. With a suspect now in custody, Harry Hansen and other police officers delved into Dylan's background and potential connection to Elizabeth Short's murder. They soon discovered that Dylan had been in San Francisco at the time of the murder and could not have been involved. It became clear that he was just a fanatic who had no actual training or experience in dissecting bodies, despite his claims of being able to perform such a procedure from having his job of driving an ambulance. However, it was revealed that Connors was a real person named Arthur Artie Lane, who had worked as a janitor at Columbia Studios. Artie Lane acknowledged knowing Leslie Dylan, but denied discussing Short's murder with him. However, he did admit to recognizing Short from working at Columbia Studios and claimed to have been at a bar with her and his wife the night before her death. He stated that he had reported this to police after hearing about her murder. When questioned, Lane's ex-wife, Grace Allen, confirmed that Lane, much like Dylan, was also a fantasist, and he'd never actually known Elizabeth Short. She provided an alibi for him on the night of the murder by stating that they were together, adding another layer to the case. It was discovered that Allen knew Mark Hansen and had even stayed with him, considered him a friend, much like Short did. With no solid evidence or witnesses willing to speak up, Dylan and Lane were eventually released from custody. At the time, they were considered the strongest suspects in the LAPD's investigation into Elizabeth Short's murder. In January of 1949, a grand jury was convened to investigate the LAPD's handling of not only the infamous Black Dahlia case, but other unsolved murders in the city. The catalyst for this investigation was the Dylan affair, which revealed the police force's shortcomings in solving these cold cases. During the grand jury proceedings, shocking information emerged. A respected doctor and surgeon was believed to be responsible for Elizabeth Short's murder. The accusation came from Lillian Dnorak, who lived with the accused Dr. George Hodel. According to Dnorak, Hodel had been seen at the Biltmore Hotel, where Short was last seen alive. However, Dnorak's claims were disregarded due to her being deemed mentally ill and committed to a mental institution. Meanwhile, Hodel himself was facing trial for incest with his 14-year-old daughter, Tamar, who alleged that her father had impregnated her and forced her to undergo an abortion performed by him. Despite eyewitness testimony, Hodel was acquitted as his defense team successfully painted Tamar as mentally unstable. But authorities were tipped off to another one of Tamar's claims, that her father had also killed Elizabeth Short and bragged about it by saying, "They'll never be able to prove I did that murder." This led investigators to find 8 witnesses who attested to Hodel's acquaintance with Short. Diving further into Hodel's background, police uncovered evidence suggesting his possible involvement with the death of his secretary, Ruth Spaulding, who died by overdose shortly after threatening to expose financial irregularities at his medical practice. It was also rumored that Hodel performed illegal abortions, a claim supported by Spaulding's possible knowledge and actions before her death. As police continued their investigation and wiretapped Hodel's home, they heard incriminating statements such as, "Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia. They can't prove it now." But before they could make an arrest, Hodel caught wind of this investigation and fled to Hawaii and then the Philippines. While some have pointed to Hodel as a prime suspect in the case, there is no concrete evidence linking him to Elizabeth Short. Despite his medical background, he was not a surgeon, and finding a doctor willing to perform abortions was rare due to the risks involved. And although Hodel had a fascination with surrealism and sadism and lived a lavish lifestyle, appearances can be deceiving, and innocence can often be perceived as guilt. However, Hodel remains a popular suspect in the case, especially after being featured in the 2019 TNT miniseries, I Am the Night. I should note that there is no confirmed proof of Hodel ever meeting or knowing Elizabeth Short, with most people around him denying any connection to her. Despite the transcripts of his home suggesting otherwise, George Hodel was cleared of molestation charges in a fair trial. Testimonies from Tamar's own mother and grandmother revealed her to be mentally unstable and known to fabricate stories of sexual abuse against 19 other individuals in the past. However, the image of a wealthy man using his connections and money to escape punishment for rape and murder is a common stereotype that many are inclined to believe. With the relentlessness and the sensationalized media hounding him, it is no surprise that Hodel fled to avoid further damage to his reputation. While some have speculated that he may have been involved in the Black Dahlia murder as part of a series of killings, LAPD ultimately did not find any evidence linking him to the crime. Nonetheless, there were several other unsolved murders around the same time that some believed could be connected to the Black Dahlia case, such as the Green Twig murder, Jean Spangler's disappearance, and Georgette Burdenoff's death. In fact, LAPD initially considered Elizabeth Short's killer to be responsible for another victim's body that was found on February 10, 1947. Janine French, who was found naked and beaten with the letters PD written on her body in lipstick. Although some have suggested that PD could have meant BD for Black Dahlia, all official reports confirm that it was intended as for PD. So this is a message for the police department. The use of lipstick as a means of conveying a message also brings to mind the Chicago lipstick murders, where two women and a six-year-old girl were killed in a gruesome manner in 1946. Despite an alleged perpetrator being convicted of the crime, there were doubts about his guilt as he claimed police had tortured him into confessing. Interestingly, Captain Donahue of LAPD states that there could be a connection between these murders and the Black Dahlia case. One witness even claims that Elizabeth Short was obsessed with this case, leading some to speculate that she may have stumbled upon the real killer. However, the probability of her crossing paths with the same killer in a different city seems unlikely. Additionally, the Cleveland Torso Killings, a series of unsolved murders from 1935 to 1938 involving dismemberment of both male and female victims, has also suggested a possible link to the Black Dahlia case. Elliot Ness, the investigator on this case, reportedly knew the identity of the killer in both cases, but was unable to make an arrest. This information is according to his biographer, a man named Oscar Fraley. There is no evidence to support this claim, though. The lack of solid evidence is a major barrier in the infamous Black Dahlia murder. Surprisingly, the LAPD have refused to release any information on the case, despite all potential suspects and corrupt officials being long deceased. Without concrete facts from the police, speculation, misinformation, and sensationalism run rampant. The public has turned the Black Dahlia into whatever they want her to be. To some, the murder is a complex scheme involving organized crime and corrupt law enforcement. Others believe it was an act of symbolism and art carried out by a skilled criminal. Some suggest it was a link to prostitution and the seedy underbelly of LA. The killer could be anyone from a surgeon to a gangster to a movie director, or simply just a deranged lunatic. And as for the victim, she has been portrayed as a seductive temptress, using her sexuality to climb the Hollywood ladder or as a lowly prostitute. There are even theories that she was pregnant, a lesbian, or just an average woman who lost her way in Los Angeles. There is no one definitive answer or story when it comes to the Black Dahlia murder. It has evolved from a case based on facts to one shrouded in myth and legend. From glamorous Hollywood to sinister criminals and from corruption to vice, everyone wants to shape this murder into something bigger than life itself. But amidst all the sensationalism, many forget the true horror and brutality of Elizabeth Short's murder. There is nothing glamorous about it. It was cruel, sordid, and merciless. Yet somehow this crime has become its own industry, with countless media projects dedicated to it. And as time goes on, new speculations and theories continue to surface, some bordering on absurdity. Without the sudden emergence of damning evidence, this case will remain forever unsolved, and any chance for justice has been cruelly snatched away. But it didn't have to be this way. The truth was always within reach, yet it slipped through our fingers like sand in an hourglass. The only thing we can do is pray for closure, knowing that it may never come. I'm Christopher Feinstein, and this is Haunted American History. The case of the Black Dahlia murder.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.